For those of you who don't know Dr. Sain, let me give him a quick introduction. Dr. Sain was born in Montreal, Quebec, Canada. And he, in 1982, he was a graduate of the National College of Naturopathic Medicine in Portland, Oregon. And he's a board-certified homeopath in 1988 by the Homeopathic Academy of Naturopathic Physicians. Dr. Sain is a very sought-after teacher. He conducts seminars in Canada, United States, Europe, all over the world. He's considered one of the foremost homeopathic scholars, has an incredible depth of insight into the work of the great masters, and he offers a 500-hour course on chronic prescribing for professionals, which is available. It's a video course, which is available through the Canadian Academy of Homeopathy. Dr. Sain currently is very busy editing his voluminous work on Dr. Adolf Lippe, and this is a much-anticipated work entitled Lessons in Pure Homeopathy from the Writings of Hahnemann's Best Student in Medicine, Most Successful Practitioner, Adolf Lippe. Well, that's what I could say, words, but, beyond the words, Dr. Sain is really one of the foremost homeopathic practitioners and educators in our community, somebody who I respect tremendously, and always it's a great honor to have him join us. Dr. Sain will be one of a number of different speakers who will be presenting at this year's upcoming LIGA 2010 conference in Redondo Beach, California. That's going to be from May 18th through the 22nd, and there will be a number of speakers. Dr. Sain, I believe, is giving four independent presentations. But there'll be many other people, including Dr. Paul Hersky, Dr. Stephen Messer, Dr. Farouk Master, Dr. Roger Morrison, and many other people. So again, Andre, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
So Andre, I know that you're going to be talking, you're going to be presenting some papers, four papers at the LIGA, specifically about a Materia Medica project involved in basically updating all of the Materia Medica, everything published from Herring's Guiding Symptoms and T.F. Allen's Encyclopedia Pure Materia Medica. Can you tell us a little bit about this project and why you're doing it, what's involved?
Well, essentially, it's something that's been published in the homeopathic literature since Herring's Guiding Symptoms or Allen's Encyclopedia of Materia Medica Pura. You can assume that unlikely it has reached us in our repertory and in our cumulative Materia Medica. In other ways, both Herring and Allen updated the Materia Medica, and from which the repertory were updated, up to their time. But since then, it has not been updated. So essentially, as a profession, the homeopathic profession has been very delinquent in updating our repertories in Materia Medica of all the new provings, of all the new the clinical symptoms that have been verified, either pure symptoms that proved symptoms that have been verified, or new pure symptoms, intoxication report, clinical experience. All of this is still buried in our journal, and this is unfortunate because, as a profession, the Materia Medica and the repertories are our most important tools. And to put aside 120 years of work and experience is a bit of a shame for our profession.
Andre, who's going to be? How many people are going to be working on this project? I mean, are there groups of people, and where are they located?
Currently, we have we do have 15 teams working on this project. There's 8 in Europe and 7 in North America, and I guess 16 with me. So each group, currently what we're doing, we're indexing the journal. So indexing the journal, that means a team. There's 8 in Europe, 1 in England, 1 in Switzerland, 1 in Holland, several in Germany, and there's here in Canada, we have 2 in Canada, and the rest are in the States, so there's 5 in the United States. And what we're doing, each team has certain journal to index, so they go page by page in the journal, and whenever they see reporting of important information. They will index it, so they'll put the author, the title of the text, what's the subject, the year of the journal, the volume of the journal, and the page of the journal, so it's easily accessible. I already started this project a long time ago, and I had indexed maybe close to 100 of the best journal, not 100 volumes of the best journal, but as there are so many journals in so many languages, we are doing it more systematically as a team now. So each team is working on a certain journal, and we're making a general index, and from that index, we're using all the cure case and all the proving symptoms to update our Mathematica and our repertory.
Andre, you know, obviously the quality and caliber of information in our journals varies. You know, you've got top-notch journals like the Organon Journal or the IHA Transactional Research, which I want to ask you about in just a little bit. But then you've also got other journals where, you know, the writings are uneven or the quality isn't quite as up to the standards of some of the better journals. Are you discriminating in terms of the what you're looking for, and are there various criteria that you're using to qualify the information so that you're really only introducing very good quality data?
As a rule, most of the journals are not high quality, and we're not very concerned with those journals, and we're not even looking at them. To give you an example, last year there was three German team that decided to work on German journal of the end of the 19th century. So after Ehring and Allen, so they started in 1890. And they went upwards, so each team took 10 years, so 1890 to 1900, and I one took 1901 to 1910, and 1911 to 1920. And the three teams quit right at the beginning because they said there was almost no valid information in those journals. So it's like we changed gears with those teams, and we had them index journal of higher quality, and as soon as they start to work on journal of higher quality, they couldn't have enough journal now. They just want to have more. So yes, we're doing the big fish where you're going to get the best information, and we're not so concerned to catch all the minnows. You know, if you catch a little piece of information out of 800 pages of a journal, that's not valuable work. On the other hand, there's some journals, every page you turn is good information, very valuable information, and that's what we're doing right now. We're doing with the, we're starting with the big, most important journal, and eventually if there's time or there's interest to do the lower quality journal, people will have plenty of opportunity to do that, but right now everyone is interested to do the high quality journal to get the most of the information right away.
You know, Andre, I'm assuming that you're spending quite a bit of time reviewing the published writings of the International Hanumanian Association, I'm sure, the IHA Transactions and the Homeopathic Physician. Could you tell us a little bit about, for those people who are not familiar with the International Hanumanian Association, could you give us a little bit of a background about how that organization came into being and its importance, really, for preserving good quality classical homeopathy?
Yes, you know, at first it was only Hahnemann that was a homeopath. And then he started to teach in Leipzig in 1811, and he started to have some students. And especially after 1813, there was an epidemic of typhus that wiped Germany, went through Germany when the army of Napoleon retreated from Russia, and they spread typhus everywhere. And Hahnemann, at that time, was teaching at the University of Leipzig, and he was supposed to be in charge of a typhus hospital, and in his typhus hospital, he had 183 patients with typhus. Mortality of typhus was about 20%, let's say about 20%. It can be higher, it could be up to 70% in poor and sick people, and maybe down to 10% at people in better health. But in general, let's say 20%, and he had no loss. So some people at university that were students there pay attention to that, and they start to pay attention to Hahnemann finally, and so he had his first student. So Hahnemann had his first student and so on, and homeopathy was not that popular until the cholera epidemic started in 1831 affected Europe. So Amiante became very, very well, much more popular. And at that time, in 1831, there were people start to interpret the word of Ahneman. So there were more books being published, more journals being published, and so there was more voice in homeopathy than just the voice of Ahneman. And the more voice there was, the less quality it was, because the voice of Ahneman was more diffused. So when homeopathy spread, especially in America, same thing happened. At the beginning, people were only followers of Ahneman or of what was called Ahnemanians. And then they were homeopathy became very popular. There was a lot of epidemics, again, cholera in 32 in the United States and in 49 and in 66. So homeopathy became very popular again through epidemics. And there was a great interest and because of the success reported. And then there was many colleges. And the more college there was, the more publication there was, the more diffused became the work of Ahneman, and the lesser quality was the practice of homeopathy. So then in the 70s, Lippe, which was a physician in Philadelphia, suggested that we should start a new association outside of the American Institute of Homeopathy to preserve pure homeopathy, the homeopathy of Ahneman. This didn't happen until 1880, when the teaching of homeopathy was very, very poor in the United States at that time. Actually, there were perhaps maybe 8 schools at that time in the United States, maybe 8-12 schools in the United States of homeopathy, and none of them were teaching the Argonauts, to tell you how bad was the situation. So they started the International Ahnemania Association because in the founding fathers, there were Americans, Canadians, and British. There was British that were there, and eventually there were more eventually that joined from different countries. So it was a majority of North Americans with a few from other countries. And they met every year after 1880, and they had their proceeding, that was their paper presented and their discussion published in what was called Proceeding of the International Ahnemanian Association. And they met until 1959. So from 1880, they founded. 1881, they had the first professional meeting where they interact with papers until 1951 when the IHA, there was only a few people left that would come to the meetings. And so they published close to 80 years of proceeding. And, you know, when I teach Mathematica, I use a lot of cases from the literature, and I would say that perhaps 7 out of 10 cases comes from the IJ because the quality of the cases as compared to the entire homeopathic literature, 70% of the cases, the better case come from the IJ. So it's just telling how good was that association. So there was the best that joined the association and they discussed their paper. You know, who in homeopathy would be a member at that time. So you had Lippe, which was the founding father, H.C. Allen, Nash, Chant, Roberts, Bolger. These are all people, Harvey Farrington. These are all the people that were very active in the IHA. There was Pierre Schmidt from Europe that was a member of the IHA, and he was a big influence in Europe and actually throughout the world to spread higher quality of homeopathy. So the IHA, as a historian, I would say that the IHA probably preserved pure homeopathy so well that it has reached us today. If the IHA had not existed, it's very, very likely that the quality of homeopathy would have continued to go down so quickly that homeopathy would have been remembered just as folklore of the 19th century, not actual a system of medicine that could survive any type of situation.
You know, with that in mind, Andre, I'd like to ask you a little bit about the work that you're doing to reactivate the IHA. But before I do that, I'm just curious, when you mentioned the 70% of the cases, are you also including the homeopathic physician as one of the publications which you would include that 70% from?
Well, the homeopathic physician was the official organ of the IHA. So when the IHA actually at proceeding and also at the journal. So while the homeopathic physician existed, their proceeding were published in the physician, and also most of the writer that would send or physician that would send cases to the physician were member of the IHA. So it was one more or less of the same thing, and the situation was very similar with the Andermanian advocate, and the same thing with the Medical Advance. And there was another one also. There was other journal like Journal of Homeopathics, the Homeopathician, another Journal of Homeopathics. There was two Journals of Homeopathics. So all of those journals were all more or less journal of member of the IHA.
Okay.
Of members that were active in the IHA and they would publish their case. So most of the cases that I have are usually from that group of people.
Okay.
And mostly from the proceeding of the IHA.
Okay.
Thank you for that clarification. So, Andre, I know that you feel that it's very important that we reinstitute a type of IHA for contemporary homeopathy, and I know that you've been working to make this happen. Can you share a little bit about your efforts in this area, what you've done, what you're hoping to achieve, your objectives with regards to a new IHA?
Sure. Listen, the situation of homeopathy today in the world is not that great. It's a bit the same thing as it was in 1880. You have a lot of people interested in homeopathy, same thing in 1880 when they founded the IHA, but the quality is not there. So there's a lot of voice, a lot of discordant voice. Most people that learn homeopathy today do not practice it 5 years after they have finished their course, perhaps with the exception perhaps in country like India. But, you know, when you talk to Europeans, North Americans, South Americans, it's usually less than 10%. Often it's 5% of people that have learned homeopathy will practice it and make a living out of it. So that means the quality is not there. The understanding is not there. What is there is confusion. Most people are confused about many things, about how to practice homeopathy, what is homeopathy, and so on. So, and that was a situation more or less in 1880, except there were some people called Andermanians that study the Andermann in terms of the instructions that are contained in the Organon and the chronic disease, and they rely especially on Andermann's Materia Medica Pura and chronic disease as Materia Medica, and they were extremely, extremely successful. So today, what we try to do is just to give another impulse to homeopathy, again, by trying to preserve pure homeopathy by making the message very clear what is pure homeopathy, how to practice it, and so it does not disappear, and it's not disappear in a sea of confusion, because that's what it is. I remember in 1994, so it would be 16 years ago, I was invited to teach in Holland, and I was there's a big group of people, about 500 people, and there was a lot of enthusiasm there. You know, 500 people is a big group to teach, and there was a director of a school that was in Holland, only type school. He, with great enthusiasm, he asked me the question, says, "What do you think is the future of homeopathy?" I could not have said the worst thing than what I said, because it was like a cold shower in the room. Like suddenly everything was silent in the room. And I said in 1994, I says, homeopathy is going to go down, and it's going to go down badly. And everybody was surprised, because in 1994, it was the opposite. Everybody was optimistic about homeopathy. And homeopathy was gaining a lot of ground in terms of gaining people's interest. And people could not comprehend what I was saying, that homeopathy would go down. And it is actually going down right now. And when you talk to people around the world, there's very, very little understanding of what is homeopathy. Listen, homeopathy is a difficult subject to master. If we really look in the history of homeopathy, I'm not sure if there was 10 people in the whole history of homeopathy that really mastered the subject. So it's a very difficult subject to master, but if we compare it, let's say, to to dentistry. People go to dental school to practice dentistry. So when they graduate from dental school, you assume that they're practicing a basic standard of dentistry. So most graduates of dentistry school, you expect them to be in practice and have a relatively successful practice. But that is not the case with homeopathy. Most people, that the great, great majority of people that learn homeopathy do not practice homeopathy afterwards. And if they do practice, oftentimes they don't practice well. The people that will practice well from the beginning will be the one that will be practicing 10, 20, 30, 40 years later.
Andre, and in terms of the work you're doing to reestablish the IHA, could you share a little bit about that? How are you proceeding with that?
Yeah, very good. So we started a group of people maybe 6 years ago to develop. Well, me, I've talked about reactivating the IHA for a long time, but 6 years ago we started to have some meetings, and we have seven people right now that forming groups that we are working on the constitution, try to reactivate the IHA and eventually have a journal and hopefully have funds to fund research project and so on. Like the Mathematica project is a very nice project that could be funded by an institution like the IHA. Yes, we're working right now to reactivate the IHA. We're only a few months away from being incorporated, but it's more than that. We need to develop a journal. We need to develop different activity for the IHA to have meanings to the IHA. If we only fund the IHA without having activity that would be meaningful, like meetings and a congress, then it will not be interesting. However, we had two Hahnemannian and international congress in the last 3 years, and the two congress were when we had those two congress, both in Germany. It was a pre-IHA meeting, so most people that were interested in the IHA were there present, and we met, and these are the core of the people that are forming the IHA right now.
Fantastic.
Well, you know, eventually, when I will be at the Liga in 2 months from now, or next month actually, I will be talking about this process of reactivation and what's the goal of the IHA, the long-term goal. One of the way we are reactivating the IHA is going to be an institution that will hopefully survive any kind of influence over the next centuries. Unfortunately, the way the IHA was first funded, they didn't plan in such a way that they didn't think that homeopathy would eventually be in that there would be so little interest in Hahnemannian homeopathy that they would have to shut down the IHA, and that's what happened. There was too few members to have an international Hahnemannian association be active when they stopped in 1959. However, we will be interested to train physicians in education programs. So we're hopeful for the future, but the way we are funding the IHA, it is for the long term.
Fantastic. So, you know, I just want to reiterate what you said about a decline in homeopathy. That's also my experience, Andre, when I travel around. And it seems to me, although I can't say I have a direct evidence for this, but at least it seems to me that those areas of the world that have most moved away from a classical Hahnemannian orientation to homeopathy, those, at least from my perspective, seem to be the areas where homeopathy is in the greatest amount of decline. And so I'm just curious, since we both seem to be observing, and you actually even predicted this decline in homeopathy going back 16 years ago, what do you think, you know, I know you're doing the IHA as a mechanism to help reverse that trend, but what else do you think is required to turn homeopathy around?
I don't think you can turn the current wave, because the current wave is confusion, so I don't think you can, you'll have to, there will be a generation or two that will have to pass, and slowly we have to, we're going to have to rebuild people in pure homeopathy, and slowly, it will be like a bit like in the 20th century. When we turned the from the 19th to the 20th century, just in the United States, it was said there was 15,000 homeopathic practitioners. Well, what happened to all those schools? There were about 20 schools at that time. There was about 60 journals. What am I saying? There was a great number of journals. I forgot the number of journals. All of this disappeared. We're in the same stage right now where there was a great interest, and now we're on the downslide. So how can you stop the downslide? You cannot stop it. It will disappear. People that are confused will just leave homeopathy. However, there will always be, like the hours has always been since Hahnemann, a few people that really understand when homeopathy, they really practice it well, and they have around them a number of students that they can teach, and those students will spread the good word. And Billing Austin was one of those persons that really helped homeopathy to after Hahnemann passed away to keep pure homeopathy. He fought a lot in the journal to fight what they used to call the anti-Hahnemannian wave. And Herring was another one, and Lippe was another person that really helped homeopathy survive. And we could say also Pierre Schmidt was also another great influence, and now he's a great teacher that had a great, great, great influence. You know, you think of a person like Guernsey. Guernsey started homeopathy, if I recall, it was in 1851. He was a bit outside of Philadelphia, and he moved to Philadelphia, and he was a preceptor of E.A. Small. So E.A. Small was a professor at the, professor at the Homeopathic Medical College of Pennsylvania. But he was not a good homeopath. He was, half homeopath. Now he practiced a bit of allopathy with homeopathy. And so what Hahnemann used to call mongrel or half homeopath. So this was the preceptor of Guernsey. So Guernsey eventually moved to Philadelphia, 1857. Listen, if Herring and Lippe had not been there, we would never have heard of who was Guernsey, because Guernsey would have continued in the way he had been trained by E.A. Small and all the other teachers that were around the Homeopathic Medical College of Pennsylvania. But slowly over the years, Guernsey woke up and became a great practitioner with great success and a great teacher also. But it was Herring was in town and Lippe was in town. So that was the influence. Now, if Herring had not been there, Lippe, we don't know what would after how Lippe would have turned. So there was Billing Austin after Hahnemann, there was Billing Austin that kept the homeopathy going, because homeopathy was really going downhill very, very fast in Germany, faster than any other place. And so Billing Austin kept the flame up, and you know, you'll be surprised to know how many people were trained by Billing Austin. There was Dunham, there was P.P. Wells spent some time with Billing Austin, Lippe spent some time with Billing Austin, there was Nunez from Spain, there was Chargé from France. So there are many people, good practitioners in Europe and in America, were trained by Billing Austin. So once Billing Austin died in 64, Lippe took over, and he was probably the major influence after Hahnemann, and Billing Austin was the greatest influence of the 19th century in homeopathy. And so many people, good practitioners, relate their knowledge to have been trained by Lippe. You talk about Nash, H.C. Allen, Kant, Farrington, so many people, the list would be endless of people that have been influenced by Lippe. So Lippe was one of the greatest influence of the end of the 19th century. So you see that it took one individual, Hahnemann, and then another one, Billing Austin, to keep the flame going, and then Herring in America got a little core of people around him, and it's spread homeopathy spread very, very nicely in America. But if Benninghausen had not been there, or Hering had not been there, after Hahnemann, very, very likely homeopathy would have died. Now, luckily, we had Hering and Benninghausen, and then after that, there was Lippe, and Lippe kept it going, and after that, there were Pierschmidt and kept it going. But overall, there were very, very few people that really mastered the subject and could influence such a great number of people as those people that I mentioned.
Very interesting. You know, Andre, one of the criticisms that's made of homeopathy, or at least classical homeopathy, is that things have changed and that you need new remedies and new approaches. And I think people are largely unaware of how incredibly successful some of these old-time practitioners like Lippe and Hering were. Could you just share a little bit about, you know, how consistently successful people like Lippe and Hering were, so people could get a sense of how proficient and masterful these people were in their practice of homeopathy?
Sure. Their success is legendary. Listen, first of all, in terms of things have changed, for sure, everything changed, but certain things, not everything changed. Laws of nature don't change. So the law of similar is the same today as it was 100 years ago or 200 years ago, and it will be the same in 200 years. A law basically is immutable. It doesn't change. It doesn't mutate. It stays the same. The Mathematica is based, the Materia Medica Pura is based on facts, observation, pure facts. So these are, it's devoid of ideas and fiction and theories and hypotheses and explanation, psychological or physiological explanation. So Mathematica Pura is based on observation, either of health, relatively healthy people are doing proving, or people, records of intoxication, or proving on sick people, or pure symptoms. So these are observations that we put in all together, and it's called Mathematica Pura. This will never change. The Mathematica Pura of Hahnemann will always be there as the basis of our Mathematica. Any other reliable proving is that is based on pure observation will be it's a stone to our foundation. So this will never change. So when people say things have changed, no, this will never change. In terms of the result that these Hahnemannians have had, it's the interesting thing is it's reproducible results. In other words, anybody that would apply the instruction of Hahnemann that are contained in the Organon and Chronic Disease and uses Mathematica Pura should get the same results as these people got, because that's what they use. And to give an example would be P.P. Wells. P.P. Wells was one that was taught by Benninghausen in Europe and also greatly influenced by Hering and Lippe. So he was in Brooklyn, New York. He was a great practitioner. He said in 1885, he said, I've practiced homeopathy for 44 years. And I have had as large practice as any practitioner can have. And I've seen cases like we all see in North America in terms of different epidemics and people with chronic disease and so on. And he said, in 44 years, I have never lost a single case with pneumonia. Now, I personally see 6 to 10 cases a patient with pneumonia a year. Now, in the times of Wells, you can assume that pneumonia was a much more prevalent condition than it is today, because there was more acute infection such as, that would lead to pneumonia, such as scarlet fever, typhus, typhoid would lead to pneumonia, measles would go into pneumonia. So there was many different conditions that would go into pneumonia that we see more rarely today. So let's assume that he saw at the minimum one case a month, because you can assume that in certain epidemics, let's say an epidemic of typhoid, he could have seen 5 cases with pneumonia in 1 week. But let's assume that he saw one case at the minimum a month over 44 years. So over 44 years, that's about 500 cases. Now, to say that he has not allowed a single case of pneumonia is extraordinary, because the average mortality in the 19th century before antibiotics of pneumonia was 30%. So 30% of people with pneumonia would have died. So that means if he had not done anything or he had practiced allopathy, he should have lost 150 patients out of the 500 patients. But he said he had lost none. It's extraordinary, but that was commonplace for Alemannia. You see these type of records all over the literature, this type of record. And this is reproducible, because myself, I have seen perhaps 200 cases of pneumonia in close to 30 years. And I've not counted them, because over the years I see 5 to 10, sometimes I've seen 15 cases in a year, but in some years maybe 4. But on average, maybe 7 or 8 cases a year with pneumonia. And some of the cases I've seen are some of the worst cases ever. And I can say that out of close maybe to 200 cases, I've lost one case. But the single case that I lost, I cannot say it's a case of pure pneumonia, because it was a boy with a brain tumor that had 2 surgery on his head. He had lost when I took him, he was in moribund. They were expecting to live just a few days. And maybe 5 or 6 months after I started to treat him, he was active, he was walking, he was talking. However, he had lost the reflex. He had lost the reflex of coughing because of the surgery and the brain tumor. And he did vomit, and he swallowed all the vomitus. His lungs were full of vomitus. And we fought with pneumonia for 6 weeks, and one night he just passed away. But, you know, the kid could not cough. So it's not an ordinary case. But I've seen some of the worst case of pneumonia. And I would say, you know, I've seen a case, for instance, a patient with AIDS that was in his dying bed. I've seen many cases with pneumonia on their dying bed. Let's say this case with meningitis, pneumonia, on morphine, on prednisone, and he's supposed to live 1 or 2 more days, and the person, we took morphine, prednisone out within a few days, and the person survived the meningitis, came out of coma, survived the meningitis, survived the pneumonia, no problem. So I've seen some of the worst cases, several cases with cancer of the lungs, supposed to die with pneumonia, nothing to do, person come back to life like nothing. It's relatively easy if you practice good homeopathy. So I would say it would be hard to conceive somebody dying of pneumonia when the doctor is at the bedside, and while the doctor is at the bedside and the patient has pneumonia, it would be hard to conceive that a person would die with pneumonia. With pure homeopathy, it would be difficult to see how that could happen. You know, you take the Pulford's brother. I think they said that together they had treated 135 cases of pneumonia, maybe more, and not a loss. So one loss. Two losses, I think. 2 losses out of 135 cases. Basically, the results are reproducible. You can reproduce that kind of result from one practitioner to the other. I'll give you an example. Yeah. There was an epidemic of malignant diphtheria in 1860 in Philadelphia. Herring, Lippe, and another practitioner, his name was Heiklum, all together at 300 cases. It was an epidemic of malignant. So the mortality was not the usual mortality of diphtheria, which is about 30-35%, but this time it was malignant, so it was above 50%, perhaps 55%, perhaps higher. So they lost not a single case. So when you have an epidemic, when you have a mortality of 50% and you don't lose a second case, 3 different practitioners, that's extraordinary. But that's what is pure homeopathy.
Very interesting. Andre, I noticed that one of the papers that you're going to be presenting at LIGA is on the place of hygiene and supportive therapies in homeopathy. And could you share a little bit about your position and what that paper is going to be about?
Sure. You know, Hahnemann was a great hygienist. In other words, it promotes the practice of hygiene, and so far were other homeopaths. You know, if you look at the letters that Hahnemann would write to his student, Hahnemann always talked about eating well, doing exercise in the fresh air on a daily basis to get the proper amount of rest, to avoid exciting situation, stressful situation, to avoid basically harmful way of living, and to adopt healthful way of living. Constantly, Hahnemann would talk about this. Hahnemann talks about it in paragraph 260 and 261 in the Organon. He talks it throughout the chronic disease. We always have to remove the cause, and if the cause is a causa occasionalis, that means caused by the way we're living or the environment we're living, we must change this and not treat the patient. The patient does not require treatment when there's a cause that when present, will make the patient sick. What we need to do is remove the cause. So hygiene is half of the practice of medicine. It's not part of therapeutics. However, the more we know about hygiene, the less we do therapeutics, but because both of them will have their right place. So the well-rounded physician is a physician that knows as much about hygiene, the cause of disease, and how to remove them, and how to encourage people to live a lifestyle that is conducive to good health. On the other hand, the physician also can be a restorer of health. So when people have lost their health, he has to know what needs to be done to restore health in the most rapid, most gentle, most complete way. And that's where both will come equally important to remove the cause of disease, let's say with hygiene, and to be able to use therapeutic to enhance the capacity of the body to heal itself. So the physician must be both a preserver of health with hygiene and a restorer of health with therapeutics. So the well-rounded physician is balanced between two. Unfortunately, in the homeopathic world, the message of Hahnemann was mostly perceived as therapeutic, using treatment. But people have forgot what Hahnemann says, the homeopathic diet, the homeopathic lifestyle, what he would call, which is as important to live a good life. So I want to show that there's many diseases that homeopaths have died of, non-homeopaths have died of, that are actually preventable. For instance, Bellinghausen died, if I recall well, at 79 years old. But he was very active, was reactive until he died. But he died suddenly from a stroke. Stroke is usually related to hypertension, and usually it's related to poor way of living. So, therefore, today, if somebody would have hypertension, it should be addressed essentially with hygiene. And perhaps that's the reason that Bellinghausen was not able to, because he had a stroke before, so it was not his first stroke. So the fact that he succumbed to a stroke was not knowledgeable enough in hygiene. And at that time, you cannot expect him to know about blood pressure because it was not known. Actually, it's a homeopath that invented the signal manometer, but people did not know about the effect of high blood pressure and their relation with stroke. However, today, if a homeopath of the quality of Bellinghausen would come and consult me as a physician, and they would have hypertension, I'll say no problem. You should never die of a stroke, my friend. And we will use whatever should be used first to deal with the problem. Essentially, hypertension is a problem of poor lifestyle. It's a person that is overfed, overstressed. It's all over. So the person has to do the opposite now, to rest the system to be able to recover from hypertension. Hering died of a massive heart attack. Again, massive heart attack. He was not under stress at that moment. He was just coming out of a large dinner. He would have he tended to have to eat a lot of heavy food, especially in the evening. He had a big meal, what is called a German dinner, that would last a long time. And not too long, maybe a couple hours after a large dinner, he succumbed to a massive heart attack. You know, the first symptom of heart disease is in 50% of people is death. Because they have their first heart attack and they die with the first heart attack. And perhaps Harry never had an angina before, any other heart attack, but anyway, he died the first one. Well, dying from a heart attack should be 100% preventable if a person would follow a good lifestyle. Hahnemann died. He suffered for many years, perhaps 20 years. Nobody can be really sure, but perhaps 20 years he suffered from what he would call severe spring catarrh. So in the spring, he would develop, around his birthday actually, he would develop a bronchitis that would suffocate him. And he suffered for many months before he died. From the time of his birth until he died in July, he suffered July 2nd, I think he died, third perhaps. He suffered from bronchitis, suffocative, like not asthma, but something of that nature. But Hahnemann was a heavy smoker, a pipe smoker. So again, that kind of death should be preventable. So but see, at that time, Hahnemann did not know the bad effect of tobacco. It was not known at that time. It was like a bit like the tobacco company not knowing it. However, today we know much more about physiology, about pathology, and we know that tobacco is dangerous. We know that if you don't eat well, if you don't exercise well, if you don't manage your stress well, you will become sick, and that these are some conditions that are actually preventable. So in homeopathy today, there's very, very little emphasis on hygiene, where it's half of medicine. So Pierre Schmidt, I remember Pierre Schmidt was one of the few physicians that emphasized hygiene of homeopath. Very known homeopath, I would say. There was Hahnemann, there was Carl Dunham, there was Pierre Schmidt, and Eugene Underhill in Philadelphia. These are the four people I can say, four homeopaths over two centuries that emphasize hygiene to be as important as therapeutic. And that's unfortunately. And that's something that the method of Hahnemann, in other ways, was not perceived clearly by most homeopathic practitioners. You just have to read the letter of Hahnemann to his patient. He talked about therapeutic, perhaps one paragraph, and he would talk about three, four, five paragraphs about how well to live. I recall Quinn. Quinn was the first homeopath in England, and he got sick, and he was an acquaintance with Hahnemann very early in the 20s, 1820s, but he consulted Hahnemann for his own sickness. He couldn't sleep, and I think he had digestive problems, but mostly sleeplessness and tiredness, and he was burnt out, and he went to see Hahnemann. And did Hahnemann give him a remedy? No. Hahnemann told him, you have to quit your practice at 5 o'clock. You have to go for a walk, 1 hour walk in the fresh air every day. And then eventually you're going to have dinner at 7 o'clock, but you're going to have dinner with friends. And you're not going to talk about medicine. You're going to talk about something else. In other words, you're going to change your mind, because Quinn used to practice very late in the evening, and then he would have a late dinner and he couldn't sleep all night. So he says, no, you're going to have a light dinner with friends, you're going to talk about other things. And so he didn't give him a remedy, actually. He just told him a hygienic principle. And so that's half of this talk is about the place of hygiene, and the other half of that talk is the place of supportive therapy. If you look at paragraph 286 to 291, it's all related to supportive therapy. Hahnemann talks about galvanism, talks about magnetism, talks about hydrotherapy, massage, and so on. So supportive therapy, there's very, very few, little interest in homeopaths to perhaps to refer or to use or to be knowledgeable, a bit knowledgeable in supportive therapy, so people can recover quicker. So I will talk also about this. I'll give some cases about supportive therapy that will help the people to recover faster than just by giving the remedy, as it should be in medicine. Because when a patient consults a physician, they want to recover the quickest possible, in the most gentle way, in the most complete and permanent way. That's how a patient perceives the physician, the duty of the physician. And actually, this is also our mission, as you can see in the first two paragraphs of the Argonaut.
Fantastic. So, Andre, I want to open it up and let some other people ask some questions. But before I do that, can you just give us an update on your Lipe book? Many of us have been waiting for a long time with eager anticipation and would love to get a copy. Could you just tell us when it's expected to be finished and just share a little bit about the book so people who are not familiar with it know a little bit about the work that you're doing?
Yeah, sure. I start to write the Lipe book. Well, I discovered Lipe about 1981. I was a student of the National College of Naturopathic Medicine in Portland. And during the breaks and between classes, I would go to the library, and I would roam around the library, look at especially homeopathy. That's what I was mostly interested in. And I came across some old journals. Well, there was the Proceeding of the International Homeopathic Association, the Medical Advance and with Acquisition, the American Woodpeck Review. So there was all kind of very, very good journal there at the school, of original copies. So I would look in there, and I noticed that the quality of the writing of the people of that time was so different than what you would hear in class or in seminars and conference and so on. So I became I became less interested in seminars and became more and more interested in the literature. And basically, it's a gold mine. The literature is a great gold mine. So in 1988, I decided to collect all the papers of Lipe and edit them and write his biography, because I recognized that he was Hahnemann's best student and medicine probably most successful practitioner. So I started to collect this, and over the years, I was able to collect probably the great, great, great majority of his writing. And I even found three more pieces in the last 12 months. But probably now it will be difficult to find a bit more than that. In any case, so I put that together, and I'm writing also like his life in terms of his life and his influence on homeopathy. Like, why was he so good? What did he do to be so good? How did he learn to be so good? What was his achievement? What was his influence on homeopathy? So it's like a biography at the same time, but not a biography where he was born, but more about his achievement. And also, I took his best writing, so it's about one quarter of his writing. So in totality, his writing is about close to 3,800 pages, and I will take maybe 800 of the 3,800 pages, or maybe a bit more, to as his best writing. And I'm introducing each article and each chapter. I'm introducing with 15, 20 pages of my own writing about the situation. I explain everything to the reader so they can understand what's the context, what people have said about this, and then there's the article of Felipe. So there's a lot of annotation. So this year I took a sabbatical as of mid-August, and I ended in mid-March. I didn't spend all the time on the Lipe. I started mostly from mid-October, because I had some congress to do and some lecture to prepare. But from mid-October until mid-March, so it will be 5 months, I work on the Lipe. So far, the Lipe book is in two volumes. It's 1,600 pages. And I've completed the first 500, first draft, which has gone to the editor. The first 500 pages finished. It's a long, long process. Just to give you an idea, if sometimes Lipe will talk about a certain subject, I found myself, let's say in December, I know twice in December it happened, that he would talk about a certain subject and I need to do some research on the subject. It would take me maybe a whole day to do research on the subject, and then it would take me two or three more days to read maybe 200 pages that I collected on that first day of research on the subject, to read them and decipher them. And finally, I would write one, two, or three paragraphs on the subject that he's talking about, and I realized I spent 4 days to write three, four paragraphs. However, it needs to be done, because The reader needs to know where we come from, what Lippe is talking about, and where we want to go with this. So I'm trying to make sure that it's very comprehensive. Everything is clear about what is said. So everybody moves together at the same time. Now, as I'm writing the book and I'm putting it together like this, and very intensively, I can see this is the gold mine of homeopathy. Actually, sometime in the maybe 1930s, maybe 1940s or 50s, sometime around that time, somebody asked Harvey Farrington to reprint Lippe's articles, because the Farrington claimed that was the best in homeopathy was Lippe's writing. And he says, yes, he says, if there would be enough interest, he said, in homeopathy, it should be done. So that means in this time there was not enough interest. And by the 1930s and 40s, homeopathy is in great decline. He says, it should be done because it is the gold mine of homeopathy. And it is actually the gold mine of homeopathy. In that way, the writing of Lippe makes everything clear about the writing of Hahnemann. Lippe touch almost every subject, and so is the book on Lippe. We touch almost every subject of homeopathy. So it makes the Hahnemann very, very clear. So students in the future will have the Organon, they will have the chronic disease, but they will also have the Lippe. And it should be read from one page to the other and reread, like the Organon has to be reread. That book would need to be reread very often. There's a lot of information, and it takes a lot of time to understand all the information is there. It's like in the Organon. You every time you read the Organon, you understand something new every time. But in Austin, after about 15 years in homeopathy, he said he had read the Organon about 15 times, and each time he learned something. And Lippe said, after 50 years, he said, of practicing homeopathy, he says, I've read the Organon about 50 times, and I'm just starting to comprehend it. Just to tell you, these were the great master, and they reread the work year after year after year. Same thing with the work of Lippe. People will have to read it year after year after year. It's voluminous, but because it touched every subject of homeopathy, the philosophy, the mathematica, how to take a case analysis, a lot of cases of patients where everything is talked about. With clinical case, I think there's about 200 pages of the 800 pages of his writing is only about clinical case. So there you have Materia Medica, you'll have philosophy, you'll have how to analyze a case. It's a wonderful, wonderful reading. It's a wonderful work. Now, somebody that would read Hahnemann and would read Lippe would never be interested in all those new approach that are by all these self-styled teachers that we have today. No, people would not be interested at all. It would assure the survival of homeopathy for anyone reading that kind of material.
That's fantastic, Andre. Thank you. And we're eagerly awaiting for the release of that work. I just want to mention to people, if you want more information about Dr. Sain, his work, any of the seminars he offers, or his video course, you can visit his website, which is www.homeopathy.ca. So that's www.homeopathy.ca. There's a lot of very interesting articles and other information that you can assess from that website. Also wanted to mention that Dr. Sain will be amongst a number of excellent homeopathic practitioners and educators who will be lecturing at this year's upcoming 65th Liga Congress, which will be held in Redondo Beach, California from May 18th through the 22nd. And if people have not yet signed up, there is a special Liga registration discount, which allows you to save $50 off the regular price. That's good through April 15th only. And the special code is L as in Larry, M as in Mary, H as in Harry, I as in Indiana, 2010. So it's LMHI 2010. That's in all caps. So if you go to the Liga website, that's www.liga2010.org, and you type in that special code, you can get an additional $50 discount. Again, this is going to be an excellent seminar. On top of having Dr. Sain, there'll be many other really top-notch speakers. So let me go ahead and open up. I think we only have time for a few questions, but let me go ahead and for Dr. Sain. Any questions?
Dr. Sain? I have a question.
Please go ahead.
Awesome. Yes, my name is Ahmed. I am a student at Resonance School of Homeopathy. My question is, that is it possible, Dr. Sen, to either publish a book or a paper on some mistakes or errors or omissions that Heinemann made during his practice, because he was a scientist and he was going through all the experimentation?
Andre, did you get that question?
No, it was too much.
He was asking about mistakes and omissions that Heinemann had made during his lifetime.
Omissions
and mistakes that Heinemann had made. I believe. Is that what you're asking about?
Yes.
Yes. So he wants to know if you've identified any mistakes and omissions in Heinemann's writings. Have these been put down some any work?
So I'm thinking right now, omission, I cannot think of like gross omission that I can see. Listen, Heinemann, like the Organon, is a blueprint of the practice of medicine. If you study the history of medicine, you will find all the great principles of medicine in that blue book. Did he miss some principle? I don't see that he missed any of the great principle. Did he do any mistakes? If he did any mistakes, there's not one that I could mention obviously above like this that he did some mistakes. People have criticized him, but I don't think any of the criticism that have been made against Heinemann have been validated. So Heinemann was a great practitioner also. Many people says, you know, he didn't have good results because they look at remote only records, but you have to go beyond the records and know other records that Heinemann had that will not be found in his book. So now Heinemann was known to be an excellent practitioner of homeopathy, and in terms of the system of homeopathy, it's only a genius could have done this, to develop this the way he did it. And so to say that there's big omission, I cannot say no.
Okay, good. Time for just one final question. Somebody have a question for Dr. Andre Sain?
Yes, I do.
Please go ahead.
Andre, you were talking about removing the cause. You know, Heinemann talked about that. Would you consider, if somebody has a food allergy, let's say to wheat, they have celiac disease, would you just remove the so that they don't have the reactions to it, or would you also treat them?
Andre, did you get that question?
Well, I think I understood. Just the person said, if a person has a food allergy, I believe it was wheat, would you remove the food, or would you also treat the patient? Well, you have to remove the most important cause. Always deal with the first cause of disease. You remove it, and then you remove other causes, because there's no diseases. Well, it's very rare a disease that is related to one single cause. You could say, like, certain type of rare disease, like muscular dystrophy, is related to one cause, it's genes. But as a rule, most disease, there's many factors in the disease. So you always want to deal with the most important factor. If the primary factor of disease is an untunement of the vital force, then you have to deal at that level. If it's related to breaking your hygienic rule, then you have to deal at that level. If somebody comes with allergy, you have to remove them from the allergens, because and if you would want to treat them because they're susceptible to the allergen. So you want to treat them with homeopathy, but you would want also to limit their exposure to allergen. Therefore, they will react much better to homeopathy than if they're constantly stressed. So yes, you want to remove other stress so they can be stronger to respond to homeopathy and heal faster. People that have allergy you remove the allergen, they recover from the allergy much better, and the sensitivity in general, not just allergy, but sensitivity in general, much better than if they're constantly exposed to the allergen or to what they're sensitive to.
Very good. Thank you very much, Andre. Let me give Dr. Sain a really big North American thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.